What is the significance of the cross experience? This is lecture 13, the story of Jesus. What is the significance of the cross experience? The churches have made great significance out of it. The churches have found the cross experience to be the drama, the magic, the intrigue, the drawing card of their activity. The churches have put Christ up on the cross. And of course, Christ was never there. Jesus, a man, went on the cross, and that's cool, but the Christ was never there. The Christ could never be limited. And they loved to have the nails into his feet and into his hands. They loved to have the crown of thorns placed around him with blood pouring down his face and stuff. They just love that, you know. Now, why do they love that? Why? Because it makes it exciting. Why is it that the books on drama, the books on murder, and the books on disobedience to the law are quite popular? Well, the reason is that the books on murder, the books on disobedience to the law, are the uncommon thing. They're the thing that happens in the very tiniest percentage of society. If a majority of society, or if even a large part of society, were involved in crime and murder and all these terrible things, this would be a terrible world to live in. We would really have trouble. But it's a very minor part, thank goodness. Now, why is it that the church turns its attention toward the ugliness and the unhappiness and saying that he died for our sins and that he has been, God gave his only begotten son that we might have life eternal? Well, who wants life eternal if you're going to live in sin? If you're going to live in problems, if you're going to be an unhappy person, who wants to, if your father gives you up to be put on the cross, that's cool, right? And so, what happens? I told you the story about Abraham and Isaac, didn't I? Mm-hmm. Or was it Jacob? Or was it Mary, Peter, and Paul? Or John? Or Jesus? You see, these are all stories that are just stories. Could a father who really loved his son put him through such a horrendous test of putting him on the altar, tying him up, putting sticks there, getting ready to burn him as a burnt offering to God? Wow. I mean, that's a sick, sick, sick being. Wouldn't you say? My goodness. And we worship that. We say he's the father of all nations, Abraham, you know, the beginning. Well, he had a good storyteller that went with him. Now, why would Jesus' father allow him to be on the cross or put him on the cross? Why would he allow that? Well, he didn't allow it or disallow it. We can do whatever we want. Go ahead, put your hand out here on a chopping block and cut it off. Ugh, terrible, isn't it? You can do that. You can do it on purpose if you want. Some people do it on purpose. And it's kind of silly. Why maim yourself, your body, your temple, when you don't have to, certainly? Now, if you're drowning in the bottom of a swimming pool and your finger is caught in the drain, you're going to snap off that finger and get out, you know, if you possibly can, because you don't want to drown. You don't want to give up the whole body just because your finger is caught. Now, that's sort of an emergency situation. But why would you put yourself in that situation in the first place, you know? And why do people do that? They don't. It's not only rare, it probably happens once in a zillion billion years. You say, well, they got reports on these things. Well, who looks at them? What is the significance of the cross experience? The cross experience, now let's just let's just take these possibilities and don't look at them at the negative as they sound, because they have to play the role. If Jesus ascended, people would say, sure, that's right. He ascended. Your master ascended, so you worship your master who ascended, and that's beautiful, you know. You worship your master who ascended, and that's beautiful. And nobody believes that he was ever even there. And as time goes by, he's forgotten. How many messiahs have come into this world and been forgotten? How many messiahs have come into this world and been forgotten, huh? Lots of them. Why don't you twist the bulb tight? How many messiahs have come into this world and been forgotten? It's hot. And they are. You don't even know about them because they're forgotten. Okay. How many people have immolated themselves, you know, burned themselves to death in the torched fire? And how often do you think about them? It's too ugly to think about it. You don't even think about it. How many people have been shot to death, you know, bang, bang, and they're a martyr for a period of time and then they're gone? Martin Luther King, he's a bigger martyr than Jack Kennedy, wouldn't you say? I mean, who pays attention to Jack Kennedy anymore? He's president of the United States and he was killed and shot, and that's an ugly thing to do, but life goes on. But Martin Luther King, he represented a culture. He represented a theme for the black people of their freedom and their right to stand up and be accounted. And so their story goes on and on and on. But the story of Jack Kennedy is merely a passing fancy. The story of other presidents who were shot in office. The story of other people who were presidents of different countries and they were martyred. Now, how about that? What do you know about Mahatma Gandhi? Mahatma Gandhi was a great guy. He taught people a lot of nonviolence aspects. But he himself was a very, 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 very violent man. Very violent man. I'm going to fast even to my death if we don't have this thing properly processed. Ah! Threatening, manipulating, controlling. Now, he's a good man. He had good ideas, but that technique was not acceptable. And he was shot, and he was appreciated for a while, but he will go down in the unknown people throughout history as a martyr and as a good man in India. But nobody will really care. It'll pass. That too shall pass. But when Jesus went to the cross, and he was convicted for something he had nothing to do, and he said, that's what they say, and still they put him on the cross, still they crucified him, still they killed him, and that was part of his program. You see, if Jesus had stopped there and been put into the tomb and been done, cooked, over, finished, the show would have been over. There would have been no Jesus Christ. There would have been no religion, no Christianity to follow them, because nobody gave a damn. But he did that one extra thing. What was that?
He resurrected.
He rose from the grave. He was resurrected. He did not stay dead. He didn't stay down. And people said, wow, you know. And there was enough people to ratify, prove, verify that that actually did happen, that society says, wow, that is something special. He said the last enemy that we will overcome is death, and he showed us how to do it. And he didn't really give us the key to get in there and unlock the tomb and get out. He really didn't. But he really did. What was the key to unlocking the tomb? You don't get in there in the first place. You don't get yourself killed in the first place. You live your life as what? in your immortal presence, in your eternal presence, in your everlasting presence. You don't need to die. Well, Herb, a lot of people have said they didn't need to die and they died. Well, that's true. That's true. Ellen is a very great lady, but she's a jerk. Herb, how you talk about your associate. Right. Ellen is a great lady, but she's a jerk. Ellen should be saying to you every single moment, this is a perfect seminar, this is a perfect seminar, everything is in divine order, everything is in divine order, it's perfect seminar, and then leave it be at that, right? Okay. And Ellen should be saying, my toe is holding perfect, my toe is holding perfect, my toe is holding, and let it be at that. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Ellen should be saying, whenever I cook eggs, they're super califragilisticexpialidocious. But no, some of her eggs are a little well done, some are not so well done, some are a little this way and some are a little that way. Why? Because she does not give equal attention to each egg. You understand me? I mean, it's a simple, beautiful illustration. But she doesn't give the same attention to each egg. She should give the same attention to each egg, and each egg would be exactly as perfect and beautiful as the other. Now, if one egg she fries a little faster, and the other egg she fries a little slower, one is kind of soupy, you know, and runny, and the other eggs are kind of hard, and you pull the yolk off with a sledgehammer, and things like that. Stupid. Ellen should know. Her mother taught her this. Her aunt taught her this. Her world taught her this. Her husband taught her this. Oh, her husband was a good cook. Her husband taught her this. He said, always cook over moderate fire and make sure that each piece of whatever it is you're cooking, vegetable, meat, fish, anything you're cooking, is perfectly done. Now, just as an illustration, when you are cooking fish and you are battering the fish in preparation for cooking, do you take this piece of fish that is so beautifully, what term do I want for it, the fish that is cut and prepared, do you take that piece of fish that is so beautifully cut and lay it in the flour, and you lay it in the buttered sauce, you lay it in the whatever you're going to put on, the special seasoning, and then you gently take it and put it in the frying pan and tenderly cook it on this side and tenderly cook it on that side so it's cooked thoroughly through, but not like a piece of leather, just a beautifully done piece of fish, and then serve it. And then you go back after turning off the stove so that you have the same procedure, and you turn it on again and you go to your next fish and cook it absolutely perfectly, and then you serve it. And then you go back and do the next for as many pieces as you have to do, patiently doing each one. You don't do that. You just get a bigger pan, and it's cold on the outside of the pan and hot on the inside of the pan, and you put your fish in there, and you don't even move them around sometimes. You flip them over so that one side was done on this side, and the other side is done on that side. One side is not done on this side, and the other side is not done on that side. And it's wonderful. It's wonderful. You got crappy food, and you think you're being a good cook. You think you're being good, but you're not giving the same amount of attention to each piece of fish that you're preparing and presenting. Now, how in the world do they, in first-class restaurants, provide food that is absolutely beautiful? How? They have a large range with a large metal piece on it with a certain amount of fire coming up under each area, balancing it. They have cooking done. They know they're going to cook so many of these things, and the cook has done it and done it and done it and done it and done it. He's been through cooking school. He knows how to do it. He does it carefully. He does it very carefully. He senses that his heart is right in that food. He is a cook. He is a chef. That's his business. He's perfect. Or else he doesn't have a job. And he does a beautiful job. He puts his 100% attention in there. And he is hired as a chef and paid well. as a chef. Now, short order cook, be the same type of thing. You make a dozen hamburgers at once. You got the burners all set in just the perfect way. You got the patties all made up ahead of time. You flop them on, you flop them on, you flop them over. You do this, and you do these things. Hey, now, this may sound silly, but it's not. This is being a perfectionist. A perfectionist in what you're doing. So if Ellen says, I'm home perfect, I'm home perfect, I'm home perfect, all the time, and no other response, only that I'm home perfect, only that I cook perfect eggs, only whatever she does it perfectly. And she has plenty of time to do that. She has nothing else that needs her attention except what she's doing at that moment. You understand? Okay, now. You want to live forever, but you say, not in this body. This body has this problem and that problem and those problems. And not as an old, mentally inadequate person or physically inadequate, but bad eyes and bad ears and bad heart and bad whatever, or you don't want to live it. You're already telling the principle how to operate its show. You're already saying, I have an imperfect body, and I want that imperfect body to cut out of here before it gets too imperfect, right? And that's what you're saying. And that's just what you're saying. And so therefore, your body does just that. Now, can you have a perfect body?
Yes.
And we teach you the songs that sing it to you. When a body, want a body that is pure and strong, then a body, want a If a body, well, anyhow. And then, it must think a perfect body, think it all day long. It must think a perfect body, think it all day long. You cannot for one instant think that your body has a problem. You cannot for one instant think that you are limited in your age. You cannot for one instant do that. You are perfect. You are perfect. Now, Dodie here is a kid, and what is she going to do? Every year of her life, she's going to be more perfect because she's going to call forth that perfection in her life. She's going to be a perfect teenager. She's going to be a perfect adult. She's going to be perfect in every way. You understand? If Dodie, stupidly, says, I don't feel so good, and I'm, bubba-doo, then that's what she's got. Because she's given all her power to not feeling so good. And she's a good actress. She can act as though she feels great even when she doesn't feel great. And then what happens is she feels great. She feels whatever show she's putting on. Okay, now, if you want to live forever in this body, you may, because forever is the timelessness of time. It doesn't make any difference. Forever can be a million years, a zillion years. It can be an instant, a second. But every instant, every second that you live is perfect. You live in your perfect body. You live in your perfect mind. You live in your perfect... This is what Jesus taught. It is done unto us according to our belief. And his belief was, hey, I'm putting on a theater. I'm putting on a show. I'm teaching stories to these people, and I'm showing them the last enemy they shall overcome is death, because that seems to worry so many of them. And so then he did that. But he had to prove that his body, the physical body, really was put out of action, or else no one would have believed it. There are people today, not today, but there are people who have written stories about the life of Jesus. And they have said how he married Magdalene, and he didn't go to the cross, that he paid somebody else to go to the cross for him. Ha, 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 ha. Sounds like the Swiss army and other armies where they pay the men to come and fight for them. A lot of people do that. In England, the lords and whatever used to do that quite commonly. They didn't want to go to fight. They wanted to stay home and run the country and so forth, and so they hired someone to fight for them, and they paid them to go to war for them. It's quite common. Now, they said Jesus did that. They said that Jesus wanted to live. He didn't want to die on the cross. Well, everyone must have been pretty blind. His mother, who was presumably at the cross experience, that's my son. He doesn't look like my son. He looks like some rotten street person who doesn't care about himself, you know. And John, Peter, and the rest of them, that's Jesus? Or maybe they were in on the intrigue, you know, on the intrigue of not having him be put on the cross. But, hey, do you think Jesus was touched by being on the cross?
No.
Not at all. Do you think that was the blood bothered him pouring down from the wounds of the crown of thorns? Not at all. How many times have you been bleeding, and you didn't even know you're bleeding? I scratched myself or button love or somebody scratched me playfully with my dog, and then I'm talking to you there and blood running down my elbow, and you say, "Herb, you're hurt." I said, "Oh, lick it up, you know, it's just a little tiny hole that got punctured in there because of the dogs playing with me so playfully." Well, it wasn't so bad, but the blood made it look bad, you know? And so this is all shows that we play. The cross experience was a show Jesus was playing, and not a bad show, but a tough show. It was like Abraham offering his son as a burnt offering. Ooh, you know, he was offering himself as a burnt offering. He was offering himself in death on the cross. And so all the people looked at this and they said, "Jesus died." And they put, there's a big story of the traditions of how they bury the body and stuff. And did they use formaldehyde in those days?
No.
Did they take the body apart? And did they take the guts out like they did with the pharaohs, you know, and put them in special bottles so that they could all be reunited with the body when the body was put back together again on the other side? No. The body was just there. The juices were out of Jesus' body because they stuck the sword in there, you know. And you could see the running water. And it was really quite something. And then he was put into this tomb. And a big rock was rolled there. And the soldiers were on duty. And they may have slept and they may not have slept. And they may have been good and may not have been good. But in the morning of the third day, the stone was rolled away. Well, now, hey, where'd he go? And he didn't leave anything behind. He didn't leave anything behind. And so then the women saw him walking along the road. And when the women saw him walking along the road, they said, they were talking about the crucifixion, which I cannot imagine they were talking about the crucifixion. Because can you imagine a couple of women walking along the road talking about a crucifixion? It was bad enough. It was dark for a couple of days, you know. Bad enough that the sun went away. They talk about the sun going away, you know. They talk about things like that. But here, criminals being hung on the cross, if they were not Christian followers or Jesus students, they wouldn't care at all. They think it was just a criminal being injured, being put on the cross. So, but anyhow, they're talking. And the story is written so charmingly that we feel that this is what really happened. Okay, so if that's what happened, that's okay. So here comes Jesus trucking along, and he goes back to the disciples. Now, how many disciples did he have?
12.
Be careful.
72.
How many disciples?
11.
11. Judas wasn't there, was he? He was out spending his money. Judas wasn't there. Now, how long did he have these disciples sleeping in his bed with him?
3 years.
And they did not recognize him when he came to them. Interesting, huh? And Thomas, what did he do? What did Thomas do?
He did not believe.
What did Thomas do? He wanted to put his fingers into the wound, and he says, "You're not Jesus. You haven't got any wounds, you know? You haven't got any stigmata. You're not Jesus." I mean, And Jesus said, whoops, better go back to the drawing board and put those things in there so that they can believe. They have to believe in the evidential, you know. So he did. And he came back, and he had all these gory wounds about him. They had, of course, healed in those 3 days that he was dead. And very fascinating. And then Thomas put it, okay, you're Jesus. Now, isn't that cool? Isn't that cool? He didn't recognize his face. He didn't recognize his demeanor. He didn't recognize his body. He didn't recognize anything. All he had to do was see the holes in his hands. Interesting, isn't it? You see, there are so many things about the story, which are kind of strange, that it makes you wonder just a little bit. Well, the church loves the drama of the cross. And all the Catholic churches and all the Catholic-type churches, you know, Episcopalians, or they've all got Jesus hanging up on the cross in the front of the church on that wonderful cross. And it was not really that nice. And Jesus was not really that comfortable. He looked pretty comfortable on their crosses. But he had a sad look on his face, and what did you do to me? That's stupid, you know. And that's not what he said. He said to the people at the crucifixion, "For this was I prepared. I'm prepared for this scene, this part of the show, and I'm doing it good." Now, what did Donald Simoda do that messed him up? In Illusions by Richard Bach, Donald Simoda is the reluctant Messiah. And in the Messiah's Handbook, it says to the reluctant Messiah, "Don't go to your death laughing. People will not understand." You see, he was a reluctant Messiah, and for him to go to an apparent death and be laughing, say, "Hi, you guys are having fun. I am too. You know, this is neat watching how you think you're playing a game." And then, of course, he came back. A couple days later, there he was, fit and fiddle. His airplane was perfect, no blood all over it like it had been, no problems in it, no big hole shot in the side of it. And Donald Simoda was just as clean as a whistle and just as sound as a dollar and just a fantastic guy. And isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? You see, the games we play are so silly. I told you the story. I had this newspaper in Atwater, California, and this old man, about 73, 74, whatever it was, 80, whatever. And he was driving along, and he drove off the road and hit a telephone pole. And broke the telephone pole off, went right through his tummy and out the back end, and spread everything apart. And there he was, sitting in his car with the telephone pole sticking in him. And I came first to the scene because I was the newspaper reporter, and we had the Atwater Signal and so forth. And so I was taking pictures of him and talking to him, and he says, "You know, this doesn't feel very good." And I said, "Why is that? You know, I mean, what am I going to say? I can understand. I can't understand. I never had a telephone pole in me. But I would think it'd be painful." And he says, "I don't feel anything. I just don't feel comfortable." Well, the fire department came, and they sawed off the telephone pole on both sides. That must have been a lot of vibrations inside him. Ugh. But what else could they do? You know. And they took him to the hospital, and they removed it. And he had not injured one blood vessel, one nothing. I mean, it was a miracle. It was a most amazing thing. And then he lived on another 10 years. What an amazing man. Well, now, you say, why did he do that in the first place? Why did he have that experience? Well, we are not inside of our other friends, even ourselves, we're not inside of, and we don't know why we do things that we do. But I do know that if you think you're whole and perfect, and then you tell me at any time at all that you don't feel good, if you tell me at any time at all that you're hurting, if you tell me at any time at all, then all I can presume is that you want whatever you're telling me. Like we say about the practitioner only sees the person perfect as they are. And the practitioner will not entertain any thought contrary to that, unless the person wants it, and then that's their business, that's fine. If you want to die, you want to live, you want to die, I say to people. And if they want to live, then we talk only on positive living thought. If they want to die, then we say, okay, tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock, you'll be dead, so call your friends in before then, say goodbye, and, you know, the show's over. You got a right to do that. You got a right to live. You got a right to die. You got a right to do this. And this is what Jesus taught, too. It's done unto you according to your belief. Herb, you keep saying that thing over and over again like a broken record. It's done unto you according to your belief. It's done unto you according to your... Well, I figure, as a master teacher, felt it was worthwhile saying a number of times, I certainly can live it, you know. I can live it and put it to work in my life and enjoy it and enjoy the benefits of it. The cross experience was not what it appeared to be. The cross experience was where a lot of people were getting it off. People had no amusement, they had no activities going on, they had no excitement, and so they loved it. They loved whenever there was a hanging or a cross experience or anything else. How did they dispose of people who were not nice? Quickly.
Cross.
Quickly.
Stoned.
They stoned them to death. Can't you imagine these mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers and children and children and children looking at this bad person there who has been terrible, and they stone them to death? My goodness, what a sick way to look at life. Hoo-wee, you know? It's bad enough you put them in prison. It's bad enough you put them on the electric chair. It's bad enough you do anything. But to do it publicly like that, oh my. This is why there are the problems that there are in the world, because we have books that tell them how to do it. You know, they had these bombings with in letters in the mail, and sent bombs in the mail. And so this went on for quite a while, and some book publishers had some people who wrote books on that, on how to do it. Techniques of book bomb publishing and bomb publishing from the mail. And they published this. They told the world what these guys did as their way. And the sick minds of the world naturally grabbed onto that, and they started doing it too. And other people began receiving bombs in the mail and stuff like that. And this terrorism thing that we have going right now is the most fascinating thing you could ever want. It's the world's lust for excitement and for adventure and for something different, you know. And really, what did God do in Genesis to his favorite children, Adam and Eve? He kicked them out. He said, you don't know how to behave in Garden of Eden. You're screwing around. You're playing around with the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which means reading books on sex and pornography, reading books on crime and punishment, reading books. See, they were kicked out of the Garden of Eden because they were getting worldly. They were getting into areas of life that were none of their business. And God knew this and knew what they were doing and said, of all things you may participate, but do not participate in good and evil, because if you do, then you will be as God. But you don't have the ability to be as God and be non-judgmental. You don't have the ability to just say it's an is and it doesn't touch me. You say it touches me. You say it is wrong. You say it is bad. You say it with judgment and possession. And this is where the problem comes. And this is where the problem came with Jesus and the cross experience. Whereas the cross experience should have been a very noble, beautiful experience of the resurrection, it wasn't. It was an experience of death evil torture. They tortured Jesus on the cross. They gave him wine or vinegar on a sponge to drink instead of water, you know. They did all these things. Actually, it was a blessing, but that's another story. You see, these are the silly things that happen. And then we worship that. We think that's the greatest thing in the world, that cross experience. And what really happened at the cross experience? What really happened was that the divine was untouched. The divine was untouched. The divine was untouched. Now I'll say that a couple thousand times more. The divine was untouched. What was touched? Now be careful. Was the human touched? Or is the human divine also? What was touched? Ellen, it's the big A. What was touched?
The attitude.
Attitude. The attitude was touched. Not the body, not the spirit, not the soul, not anything physical, mental, or spiritual, except an attitude might be a mental type thing, but it was the attitude. They took a negative attitude about it. And because they took a negative attitude about it, it was bad. Now, if you have a leg that has cancer in it, and they have to cut that leg off so the cancer doesn't get to the rest of your body, you can say, I don't want to lose my leg, I don't want to be old. Or you want to say, take it. I'll get a prosthesis. I do not want to let that cruise through my whole body. Your attitude said, hey, take it. No problem. I can live beautifully with that. No problem. In Forrest Gump, remember? Forrest Gump had his lieutenant who lost his legs. And the lieutenant was so unhappy about it. He was so unhappy about it. He was so unhappy about it. Until, through a series of events, he grew up. And he realized that he could do almost everything. And then, what did he do, finally? He finally got himself a set of legs. And he began walking on it. Not totally perfect yet, but he began walking. And he began looking at life totally different, not from his wheelchair any longer, but from standing on his own legs, even if they are the legs that he bought. But he's standing on his own legs. You see, we look at things sometimes from the wrong perspective, and so our attitude is based on that perspective. Yeah. What was the attitude God had toward Adam and Eve? It's a story, true, but what was the attitude God had? God had, hey, if you can handle it, go for it. But I can see that you can't handle it. Adam, where are you? Eve, where are you? We're hiding in the bushes. Why are you hiding? Because we're naked. Naked? They were naked from the beginning. They never had a stitch of clothes in their entire lifetime. And then all of a sudden, they're naked. Well, you see, naked meant that they were ashamed of themselves. Naked meant that they had no confidence in themselves. They didn't believe in themselves. And you see, that's what naked means to us, too. When we are afraid and must wear clothing under all circumstances, we don't have any confidence in ourselves. But if not wearing clothing is acceptable, and we don't wear clothing, we have confidence in ourselves. We don't think about it. A person looks at you, yeah, okay. You're like most every other human being, you know. You're this way or that way. You're fat, you're thin, you're short, you're tall, you're whatever. But hey, you know, whatever. But you see, they were ashamed of themselves. And what did the people do after the crucifixion? They were ashamed of themselves. They went away in great shame. What did the disciples do? If you want to see someone who is really ashamed of themselves, look at the disciples. Who was there at the crucifixion? They say John. Where was Peter? Never mentioned. Yeah. Where were the rest of the disciples? Never mentioned. They weren't there. They were ashamed. They were ashamed that their teacher, their leader, their master, their God should be crucified, should be so poorly handled, so poorly treated, and they did not stand up for him at all. They said he wanted to be the king of the Jews, which was, of course, a lark, but they said he wanted, and not one stood up to say, no, he doesn't want to be the king of the Jews.
He is.
No, he doesn't want to be the king of the Jews. He's God. No, you see, they didn't stand up in any way, in any way. And they were so ashamed. And because they were ashamed, they couldn't do anything. You do not hear anything about the disciples throughout the entire Christian history. Oh, they're written in, but they were not there. The Bible itself, the New Testament, the Gospels, were not written until 50, 60 years after the crucifixion had taken place. You understand? And how old were those guys at that time? My goodness, they were over the hill. Because 30 years was the median age at that time. And you see, so these are old bucks. And what did they do? They all went their way. They all went off to their various paths. And when Peter and Paul got together, they hated each other. Peter learned none of the compassion, none of the spiritual love that Jesus taught, or he would have said to Paul, I forgive you. I forgive you for trying to crucify my master, you know. You didn't make it, but I forgive you. And, of course, he can't forgive because that's not his prerogative, but Jesus said forgive 70 times, 7 times, you know. But he didn't forgive. And he says, look, I don't want you around me. I don't want you, your vibrations around me. I don't want your slaughterhouse vibrations around me. That's terrible. Oh, my God, you know. And instead of saying, all is perfect, all is in balance, all is harmony, all is right action, all is peace, all is truth, he said, I don't want you. And so Paul says, okay, I have a mission in me that tells me I must go out and preach and teach and heal. And I will just not know anything of what Jesus told you guys. I'll just know what I believe Jesus tells me, and I will follow that. And he went and did it. And because of him, the Christian church is here at all. Because if it hadn't been for him, there would be no church. There'd be no writings. There'd be nothing. The four Gospels, which were the two Gospels, which were the one Gospel of Matthew, it would never have been there in the first place. Because who cares to read it? Who cares to follow it? Who cares to know about it? And the crucifixion itself was a very wonderful show. I mean, they could have really made good notes off of it if they wanted to. But they didn't. They didn't. They could have told how Jesus went to the cross. And instead of saying how he stumbled up the hill because it was too heavy for him, too heavy for him? Anything too heavy for the Christ, for Jesus Christ? My goodness, no. And then that they had to help him, that he was weary, that he was tired. He doesn't create a scene where he's wearied and tired. He's master of the whole thing. And then when they put a sword in his side, you know, did it hurt? No. And then he shouted out his last words, Elohim, Elohim, you know. And what was he saying? Father, Father, for this was I prepared. And yes, it was an interesting event. Yes, he was a good actor. Yes, he allowed himself to appear to be hurting, to appear to be badly used and badly misused. If he didn't, it'd be a joke. It'd be a joke. What would it be like if Jesus was nailed to the cross and then he said, oh, I'm done with this. And so he pulls the nails out of his hand and he steps down from the cross to go pop, pop, pop. You know, his hands are all back in shape again, which never were out of shape anyhow. And his body, you know, boop, and the juice goes, you know, back into the body. You know, he could play the game.
He could have done that.
And what miracles that would have been. And my gosh, the people would have been shook. And they would have said, it's unbelievable. No, 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 it didn't happen. It didn't happen. You know what I mean? They would say, it's impossible. And he could have done that and had a ball, which he did do. But he did it a little more gently. He did it in the tomb. Now, what is your thinking on that? And I'm not asking you what your thinking is. I'm asking, what is your thinking on that? Do you believe that the cross was necessary or not necessary? It doesn't matter, it was there. Do you believe that it enhanced the story, that it gave the story of Jesus and what he was teaching a more permanent, prominent, positive attitude for the people to follow? Or do you believe that the cross experience was just an unnecessary part of the show? I know what you're thinking. I know what you're thinking. You watch these movies, and then you see the violence in there, and you see the tough stuff in there, and you say, I don't want to watch that. I don't want to watch that. I don't want to watch that. Well, watch it. And surround it with your pure white light of love. See through it. See past it. See the illusion that it is. And see why it's there. It's there to get readership. It's there to get attention. It's there to get people to listen. And if people can listen to Forrest Gump and find the beauty that's in it, and looking past the ugliness of how people mistreated him, he did. Well, he was so stupid, he didn't know it. Well, maybe we should be so stupid and not know it. Maybe we should be so beautiful and uplifted that we don't know these things are happening. I don't know how Switzerland was or Germany was or anything, but I know here in America, we had names for our enemies, you know, the Japs and the Huns and all that sort of good stuff, you know, and the Krauts, or the, which are the Huns and what have you. And all these different names. And here in America, it's a very stupid thing to do, but here in America, we lived next door to the Japs and the Huns and the Krauts and the Polaks and what do we call the Italians, the whatever. Well, we had names for everybody. And like I always like to tell the story that my grandparents, my great-grandparents were born in Pomerania, in the Tsarist country, not Tsarist country, but in the Kaiser country of Germany, where all the Kaisers came from, you know, where all the big wheels came from and all the neat people came from. And Polaks, ugh, those Polish people, you know, they take six of them to put in a light bulb and that sort of stuff, you know. And then the war ended and the land was redistributed and all of the Kaiser country, all of that very noble German country went over to Poland. Well, how interesting. You see, we never, even in jesting, we never can allow ourselves to play games because we're going to have to eat it sooner or later when we play the games. Us kids, we really didn't know what it all meant, but the adults were saying those things in our presence, you understand? And we picked those things up without knowing it. I used to go down to the YMCA and go swimming. And when I'd be swimming down there, I'd meet a lot of different people and from a lot of different races and a lot of different cultures. And the Martha Graham dance group was down there, and they had invited me to play with them and dance with them and stuff like that. And that was kind of fun. And so one evening after the program, I invited one of the young men to come home and have dinner with us at my home. And so he came home. And I never go in the front door of my house. I never go in the front door. But this night, we went in the front door. And Mother served a nice dinner. We had a nice time, had good talk. And then after he left, Mother says, "What are you doing to our family?" And I said, "Well, what's that, Mom?" She says, "Well, you don't bring a black person in the front door. They are your help. You bring them in the back door. If you bring a black person in the front door, that means that they are your equals, your peers, and, you know, and stuff like that." And I said, "Well, Mom, he's no different from me, you know. I mean, he's a nice guy." And she says, "But the neighbors." And I said, "Okay, Mom, okay." But you see, isn't the silly? Here we lived in a very nice neighborhood, and and I brought this black kid in the front door with me, and it was night, and people had to really be peeking to see us come in the door. But it's fascinating, the games we play, and how my mother, who was totally loved, totally fantastic in every way, was still bothered by how the neighbors would take it. Us kids had to always behave because what would the neighbors think? You know, what would the neighbors think if you did this or if they saw that? And we should always live for ourselves. And I did, basically, and I do, as you can tell. And I have a very wonderful and happy lifetime and a very great and a very wonderful experience. But you see, the cross experience is whatever we want to make it. And as far as I'm concerned, it never happened. As far as I'm concerned, Jesus, the Master Teacher, lives, lived, and always will live in my heart, in my love, and in my joy, and as my greatest benefactor and teacher that of a philosophy that I dearly love. And with that, I will say to you, I love you too.